Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and Dahlia Lithwick, the senior editor and legal eagle from Slate, is here now to talk about the politics of the insanity defense. In a piece on Slate today, she asks, if you're saying today that Jared Loughner was crazy, not political, will you say tomorrow that he should be found not guilty by reason of insanity? We know that many people will not wind up there. Hi, Dahlia. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for having me.
And you can just hear the defense playing talk radio sound bites in the courtroom. Rush and Sean and everyone else saying, this guy was a nut job, not a Tea Party activist, just a nut job, a lunatic. And even people on the left are grudgingly coming to that conclusion, even while saying crazy people can still be set off by a politically hypercharged atmosphere. Is that what got you thinking about this?
Well, it did, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think I was specifically responding to a David Brooks column in the New York Times where he actually sort of went further and tried to sort of diagnose him and really, like, take a mental picture of his brain. And it just seems to me, A, that's incredibly premature. I mean, everybody's throwing around words like bipolar and paranoid schizophrenic, and we actually know nothing. And so I think that to throw up this mental health diagnosis on the left or the right as a way of deflecting, you know, what may or may not be fair criticism, but is certainly criticism about the way we talk to each other and whether he was incited to violence, I just think it's sort of replacing one sin, the sin of laying blame, with another sin, which is this armchair diagnosis. I can't tell you, Brian, how many emails I've had from people who look at that shot that we're all seeing with the shaved eyebrows and the shaved hair and say, mm-hmm. look at him, he's clearly crazy. And I just don't think any of us should be in the business of making mental health diagnoses from afar.
So you wouldn't even hazard a guess as to whether an insanity defense would be an open and shut case in Jared Loughner's situation.
Well, I think the more interesting problem, and, you know, it's a sort of a subtle argument, and I'm not completely sure I made it in Slate, but I think the interesting problem is that the insanity defense has been a political football for as long as, you know, murder has been a political football. In other words, we have entirely crafted the jurisprudence of the insanity defense to follow our political feelings about the insanity defense. It's not a medical or psychiatric defense. It's a completely political animal. And so the point I was trying to make is, if you're going to say, oh, you know, as a political matter, we are all blameless because Loughner was clearly crazy, we also need to reckon a little bit with the utterly political insanity defense and how it has been shaped over the years in response to not, I think, medical or empirical data, but political data, but most obviously after the 1981 John Hinckley shooting of the president, mm-hmm. when everyone decided they were an expert on mental illness.
And listeners, we can take some calls for Dahlia Lithwick on this. Maybe you're a lawyer who's used the insanity defense or decided not to. Maybe you're a mental health professional. Anyone on sort of the side science and politics of the insanity defense, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Dahlia, is there a standard legal definition of not guilty by reason of insanity, or does it vary much from state to state?
Well, there have been trends. States do different things, and then the federal government does different things. But, you know, just for the quickie history of the insanity defense, Brian, the original test was called the McNaughton test, and this comes out of a 19th century a Scottish woodcutter mistakenly kills an aide to Robert Peel, the British Prime Minister, thinking he's killing Peel himself, and he invokes the insanity, and the jury accepts this. They acquit him, and they say he's not guilty by reason of insanity. And the test is essentially, did he know right from wrong? Then there's this big uptick in 1950s in dissatisfaction with this McNaughton test. And we have a lot of psychiatric experts who are weighing in and saying, wait, knowing right from wrong is not all of it. There's this question of control and impulse control. There's a question of whether some mental disease or defect, that's the language that's used, mm-hmm. Causes this. And then that, you know, there's a sort of hybrid standard called the ALI standard that's adopted in 1962 that it's kind of takes the best of both those worlds. And then, as I said, in 1981, John Hinckley shoots President Reagan, and America goes crazy, and you have people like Dan Quayle saying that this just allows, quote, pampered criminals to kill with impunity. And everybody in the country says this was a trick. He got off. He was, you know, clearly fine. He was clearly guilty, and this was a trick. And that's when the states and the federal government really tighten their standards, and we go back to something that looks an awful like that original McNaughton test that doesn't ask this question of control, that shifts the burden of proof to the defendant, and it raises the burden of proof so that the it's much harder for the defendant to prove, and then also sort of says we're going to do away with this control question. We're going to merely ask the question, did he know what he was doing was wrong? Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that's so important is that even though we have this notion in this country that millions of people invoke the insanity defense and get off and, you know, lay about on lounge chairs, it hasn't worked out that way. It's almost never proven. And when people are found to have been insane, there's never less committed to psychiatric institutions. They also often spend more time there than they would have in jail.
Where's John Hinckley Jr. today?
He's in an institution. And I think one of the other interesting wrinkles, and this is specific to places like Arizona, there's this new thing that says you are guilty but insane. That's kind of even tougher than the McNaughton standard. And what that says is the jury has found you guilty, but they're going to allow you to be in an institution or to be treated until you're not insane, in which case you go to jail. So there is this other thing. Certainly that's going to be an issue in the state trial for Loeffner. But there's this other thing that says we're going to incarcerate you either way, but we'll treat you. So that's where some states are today.
Dahlia Lithwick from Slate on the science and politics of the insanity defense as it pertains to Jared Loeffner and others. Janet in South Plainfield, you're on WNYC. Hello, Janet.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. The gun issue aside, the politics of mental health care are out of whack in this country. In 2008, they refused to put mental health care on full equity with physical health care. And until that's changed, people won't be able to get health care. You know, and then you put on top of that decreasing gun waiting periods in 1999 from 3 days to one. You know, so it ends up going back to politics. And until there's a little sanity in politics, there will not be safety for people who aren't sane.
Janet, thank you. Do you think that the Loeffner case shines a light on access to mental health care? Dahlia, from, you know, my reading of the press anyway, the casual impression seems to be that a lot of people knew that he was very troubled and he didn't go for care. But I have no idea whether there was access, whether he tried but wasn't insured and couldn't afford it or any of that. Do you know?
My understanding so far is the same of yours. I know that when he was told to leave his college, he was told, don't come back until you have a clean bill of mental health. And my understanding is he never sought that. But I think that Janet makes an important point, which is, you know, this is a really good moment for us to be having a national conversation about health care instead of sort of retreating into this place that says, oh, my God, he was clearly crazy and therefore somehow totally responsible at the same time that he was totally not responsible. This is a really good moment, Brian, to say there was a really good report that I saw in Huffington Post that said in 2010, 50% of the mental health services recipients in Gabby Giffords County were all dropped from the rolls. So I think that it's not just that we don't have adequate mental health care in this country. We don't even know who's responsible for getting someone to acquire mental health care. We don't even have the vocabulary to talk about it. If folks are being denied mental health care and we don't talk about it right now, we are, you know, in bigger trouble than we think.
Glenn in Park Slope, you're on WNYC. Hello, Glenn.
Yeah, hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay.
I'm not quite sure where to start. I'm a psychologist. Retired, actually, from inpatient work. I still have a private practice. And I have both a personal and a professional connection to this. The personal connection, which is a rather painful one, is my cousin, who was Dr. Wayne Fenton, actually was profiled on NPR a couple of years ago, was killed by a patient that he was seeing. He was a Washington, D.C. psychiatrist and actually one of the foremost experts on schizophrenia. And even he, in that setting, wasn't aware that the person he was with could be violent, obviously, in the manner that he was. So that's on a personal level. On a professional level, working inpatient, one of the things that I observed periodically was when someone came in and they were floridly psychotic and clearly needed to be hospitalized and also needed medication, they had the right to refuse. And there is a procedure you're probably familiar with called 2PC, where two physicians certify that the person needs treatment. However, the person is then given a lawyer, and it's taken to court if they refuse. The hospital is often in a dilemma there, because if they start medicating a person, and they can do it against their will, if they're restrained, they can give them injections, the florid nature of the psychosis eases up some degree. They go in front of a judge, and they don't appear any longer, although they certainly don't appear to be fully intact, but they don't appear to be as floridly psychotic, and certainly don't appear to be a danger to others,
right,
or to themselves. So I used to be part of discussions where people would say, well, maybe we shouldn't medicate this person. Let them go in front of the judge. Let the judge see what this person is like in an untreated state, and then they will be involuntarily hospitalized.
Boy, there's
so it's
a
very complicated problem.
There's a moral dilemma for you, huh?
Yep.
And so having been so close to this with a patient having killed your friend.
Not my friend, my cousin.
Your cousin, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Did you want to see that patient acquitted on the basis of insanity and still locked up or institutionalized anyway, or found guilty because there was something that wanted you to see him get a guilty conviction?
No, I had no desire to see him get a guilty conviction. And in fact, my cousin Wayne used to say, why is it that if someone has Alzheimer's, we wouldn't allow our grand— I think his quote was, we wouldn't allow our parents or our grandparents to be living in cardboard boxes on the street if they had Alzheimer's. Why do we allow the mentally ill to do that?
Fascinating. Glenn, thank you very much. Dahlia, any reaction to Glenn?
You know, a couple. I mean, I think that it's kind of a heart-stopping story.
Really?
I think, you know, one point he makes that's so important is that there's always a clash between the rights of the mentally ill and society sort of seeking to protect themselves. And that doesn't just happen, as he says, at trials. It doesn't just happen when they're involuntarily medicated. One of the really interesting things that we've learned about, just thinking about Judy Clark, who's going to represent Jared Loughner, is that she was in a constant struggle when she represented Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, because she was pleading guilty, and he, as you may recall, she was pleading insanity, and he didn't want to be called insane. And there was just a constant struggle, it seems, between them. Was she acting in his best interest? What about the fact that he felt shamed and demeaned by it? So I think this plays out at every level, you know, these questions about why couldn't someone force Jared Loughner to get treatment? Well, because we don't do that in this country. And this is just a very fraught question that I think we have to think harder about. You know, the only other thing that I would say is that it seems to me that we don't know when someone who is mentally ill is going to become violent. And one of the really important things that Glenn just said is, you know, even the guy who his cousin who was treating this person didn't know. And so while we run around looking for red flags in Jared Loughner's life, it's A, so important to remember that most mentally health people are not violent. They're not going to be violent. There's a complicated interaction with drugs, which he was using, and violence, and that we have to be so, so careful in this conversation to be very, very aware that it's almost impossible to predict that all sorts of people at Jared Loughner's life in his community college said, you know, yes, he's super weird, but I don't see signs of violence, and that's a very tough thing to know in advance.
Dahlia Lithwick from Slate, writing on the politics of the insanity defense. Do you think that Sarah Palin's and the president's use of the word evil when talking about the massacre is a way of getting around the question of insanity?
That's a great, great question, Brian. I mean, I think it's a way of cabining something that we don't yet know enough about. If we call it evil, the act evil, maybe we don't have to make a determination right now about what was responsible. But I do think that Sarah Palin's, you know, sort of claim that everybody is sort of responsible for their own actions, right? And we don't blame a state and we don't blame the culture. That's one version of responsibility. I thought President Obama's was really interesting. He was saying, you know, we're all responsible for everything, including the way we talk to each other. So I do think there's sort of an interesting agency question going on there. I think in the end, it seems to me, if you're going to use the McNaughton test, the test that we currently use, which is, did this person know right from wrong? There's no place in that definition for evil. I think that Andrea Yates, you know, the woman who killed her children famously, she thought she was doing the right thing. She did something utterly unspeakably evil, but she was so profoundly psychotic, she thought she was doing the only moral thing when she killed her children. And I think it goes to show that this language of evil, this moral language, doesn't map very well onto what we know about mental health.
But is some of the political resistance to the insanity defense really a religious resistance, that some religious people feel that if insanity is seen as the bottom line, then it, you know, it leaves the realm of good versus evil, and they don't want to leave that realm?
I think that's absolutely right. I think we want to have those sort of comfortable moral boundaries. And I think there's also a massive slippery slope problem. When the test was about control and mental defect, there were an awful lot of people who could claim that they were insane who were really on the margins. In other words, I think it swept so many people in who really were evil and immoral that the feeling was that that test had no boundary. And so I think somewhere between an extreme test that doesn't make a lot of space for people who cannot control the evil in their souls, and people at the other end who can cite, you know, God was talking to me and try to exonerate themselves, there needs to be, I think, a much more sophisticated conversation about the real difference between our legal system and our moral system and right and wrong, and the mental health system just doesn't dovetail with that.
Yeah, we have a comment from somebody posted as, that's H followed by four M's, who writes, I'm from the UK, where there's something called diminished responsibility as a defense, which departs from the knowing right from wrong standard. Dezed in Nassau County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dezed, thank you for calling.
Good afternoon, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a physician. I see a lot of patients with this different mental issues and mental problem. Very, very difficult to get the referral to the going to the right place for this patient. First, the family and the patient has to admit as to there is something wrong with them. Then the second thing, the stigma with it, which they don't want to admit. Then the third thing, just getting referred to the right place or, you know, right facility. It's almost impossible, you know, and that's compared with every other specialty, much easier for make a referral to anybody else, except, you know, psychiatrists or psychologists.
Does this ever happen when you have a patient who you fear might become violent?
That's true. The only way that I can admit him or just get seen right away almost, if I put that as a suicidal, then almost they're going to admit him or just they're going to admit him. Otherwise, if it's not, say, suicidal, most of them, they cannot get an appointment on right time, and sometimes they're even longer than usual to be seen by psychologists.
There you go. Important point. And it backs up what you were saying before, Dahlia, about access. Becky in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Becky.
Hi. I just want to say in a larger perspective that, aside from this particular individual, that there one obstacle to access and successful treatment of all forms of mental illness is a pervasive culture of stigma around mental health, which under parity law can perhaps move toward being seen, as doctors see it, as a, more of a brain illness. But one thing that all of us could do today to alter that culture, and you, Brian, could help, is to be a little more careful about language. Epithets that you've been using on the show today, like nut job, crazy person, lunatic, those reinforce prejudice, and it's a kind of language that needs to be rooted out in the same way that we've rooted out language that's insensitive about overall mental development, about sexual preference, about race, that as long as that language is the way that people on the most left show I can think of are willing to talk about a person, even if it's, oh, people on talk radio may be saying, oh, he's a nut job, the more we're all willing to continue using that language in a way that we would never dream
right.
of using other epithets.
I completely agree with you. And my policy on the show is to not use those kinds of terms ever, other than the way I did today, which was to quote what's going on, you know, out there in commercial talk, which I've heard 1,000 times this week.
Yeah.
Loeffner is a nut job. He's a loon. You know,
right.
He's crazy. All of this stuff, and that, you know, to set up the idea that Dahlia was coming with.
So I
really agree with you.
I hear you, but I think it's difficult because we hear our children use these same terms.
Yes.
They're terms that are sort of casually used in a way that we would never casually
That's
use.
That's right,
a
and
kind
I think,
that,
and as parents, we have a responsibility to talk to our children when they use terms like that, because we don't know who's around who actually has an issue with mental illness, who's going to be victimized by it. But it really gets back to your initial thesis, Dahlia, which is the question. You know, if you're saying today on talk radio that Jared Loeffner was crazy, not political, will you say tomorrow that he should be found not guilty by reason of insanity, when usually the more conservative position is no, insanity defenses just let people off the hook? And that's the dilemma. I guess we'll find out the answer to that question.
I think we will, and I would add, I'd sort of double down on that paradox by saying the same people who are saying today that he is utterly not responsible for his actions, there is no agency, there is no causation because he's insane, need to take responsibility for the other half of this conversation, not just the insanity defense, but the guns piece, which we didn't talk about today, mm-hmm. which is how is it possible that somebody who is clearly very mentally ill, so much so that he was thrown out of school and couldn't be in the military, could so readily purchase a weapon. And so I think these paradoxes, and I completely agree with Becky, the idea of marginalizing people and stigmatizing allows us to talk this way. But I think part of taking responsibility for the whole picture is to say, if he was as ill as talk radio suggests this week, what do we do about the fact that it was so readily available for him to get a semi-automatic weapon?
Right. So before you go, I just want to ask you about, since you're, you know, a court watcher, about the defense attorney for Jared Loeffner, who you mentioned before. What's her name again?
Judy Clark.
And she has defended the Unabomber and Susan Smith, who drowned her children, right?
Yeah.
And others like this?
Yeah, the Olympic bomber, and she was involved in the Zacharias Moussaoui defense. So she is, I almost want to say, one of the Where's Waldos of the, you know, she pops up in the defense in some of the most unspeakable crimes that we know of.
It's an interesting career choice. Why would one make it?
Well, she is passionately opposed to the death penalty. I think that's a part of it. And one of the things that she does is she is the person who convinces these folks to negotiate a plea deal so that they are spared being executed. So I think that's sort of the end game, is that these tend to be capital cases, and she manages to persuade them that it's in their interest not to die. But I think more poignantly, and you know, this has got to be the sort of theme song of everything we've said in the last half hour, Brian, I think she really wants to bring these people to life before the jury. I think she takes people who look like monsters and says, look, here's who Ted Kaczynski really is. Here's who Susan Smith or Zacharias Moussaoui really is. And in its attempt to, and this often happens at the sentencing phase, to say, before you make those easy black and white moral decisions about who is evil and who is not, here's who these people really are. Here's what they're struggling with. And I think she has a real gift for doing that. And so I think for her, it's a way of bringing some of these people who are portrayed as utter monsters into a much more sort of subtle light before a jury.
Well, I guess we'll hear a lot from Judy Clark over the coming months, and we will no doubt hear a lot more from Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate.com. Thank you so much for a great conversation.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and still to come, we will talk next about vaccines and autism, the role of scientific error and scientific fraud, and then we'll have a call-in for college students and 20-somethings on how you're planning around this common notion that you will be the first generation of Americans to live less well than your parents did, and where in America you would most like to live. So both those things coming up. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.